Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We were greatly heartened by the most uplifting news we heard from Palestine in many years when Gaza's Palestinians stormed out of their imprisonment on Wednesday, January 23rd. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians burst into freedom from the abomination of Gaza's cage and the obscene medieval siege imposed on them by the governments of Israel and the United States, with the consent of the United Nations and the European Union. Thousands went to stock up on much-needed food, water, and medical supplies at the Egyptian town of El Arish. Many headed for Cairo to seek desperately needed medical care or to pursue their studies. Egyptian border guards and riot police at first attempted to drive the Palestinians back with batons and water cannons before giving way under orders from Egypt's President Mubarak. Later, tensions arose when Egypt prohibited its store owners from restocking their merchandise, probably in an effort to drive shoppers back into Gaza. The United Nations has estimated that as many as half of Gaza's 1.5 million people may have crossed into Egypt. Some Israeli officials gloated. Israeli President Shimon Peres declared that, quote, "the responsibility for Gaza is now in the hands of Egypt," unquote. The Israeli newspaper Arut Sheva reported that Knesset member Aryeh Eldad hailed the exodus as proof that, in his words, voluntary transfer is indeed an option. 3 days after the breakout on Saturday, January 26th, as part of the International Day of Activism, between 1,500 and 2,000 Israeli activists, despite heavy rains, traveled in a convoy from all over Israel to the Erez Junction to bring 3 tons of much-needed supplies to Gaza. The events, which included a convoy, a rally of the Jewish and Palestinian activists inside of Israel at Erez, and a parallel rally of Palestinians inside Gaza, were the collaborative work of the Palestinian International Campaign to End the Siege on Gaza and about 20 different Israeli organizations. The rally was emceed by Khulood Badawi, a very inspiring Palestinian-Israeli woman. Speeches were given by prominent Palestinians and Israelis, including Palestinian psychiatrists Dr. Iyad Sarraj, founder and director of the Gaza Community Health Program and Commissioner General of the Palestinian Independent Commission for Citizens' Rights, former Knesset member Uri Avneri, Dr. Jeff Halper, founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and Hebrew University professor Nurit Peled Elhanan. Israeli border guards prevented the rally participants from delivering their supplies, assuring them that the supplies would be allowed in a couple of days later on Monday. Knesset member Dov Hanin further reassured the activists, saying that Prime Minister Olmert had told him personally that the relief convoy would be allowed in. But that was all part of Israel's well-worn approach of yesing people to death and never delivering on anything. Predictably, Monday passed and the supplies have yet to be allowed into Gaza. Demonstrations demanding the end of the siege on Gaza were held all over the world, including in Boston. The Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights held a demo on January 26th in Harvard Square in Cambridge, attended by 100 people. And Jewish Voice for Peace held a demonstration on January 24th at the Israeli consulate in Boston, attended by at least 100 people. JVP brought medical and food supplies in boxes and a letter addressed to the consul, but the consul refused to have anyone from the consulate meet with the activists and surrounded the offices with a dozen Boston police officers to prevent anyone from entering the building. Throughout the past week, Egyptian forces have been filling in the holes in the wall at Rafah with barbed wire, and on Thursday, Egyptian forces, with the cooperation of Hamas, began preventing all traffic into Egypt, allowing only Egyptian supply trucks to enter Gaza. Today we have the pleasure of welcoming to our program well-known Palestinian journalist and photographer and blogger, Ms. Laila Al-Haddad, who divides her time between Gaza and the United States. Her excellent articles have appeared in The Guardian, Al Jazeera, and Electronic Intifada, among other publications. To learn more about Ms. Al-Haddad, please visit her blog at amotherfromgaza.blogspot.com. She joins us now by telephone. Good morning, Ms. Laila Al-Haddad. Thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
It's our pleasure. Congratulations on giving birth to your second child.
Thank you.
She must be all of 1 month old now.
Yes, I'm nursing her as we speak. So.
Oh, great. How is your son doing, and how is he taking to having a younger sister?
He's great. I mean, he's a wonderful older brother. He's very, very excited, you know, about having her around, and having a new presence is always, having a new human being around is always something, you know, that gives the entire family a lot of hope and meaning, especially in these difficult circumstances. Which, you know, I should mention that Yusuf has not forgotten about. I mean, he's every now and then will be watching the news, and he'll hear the word Ma'bar, which is, you know, crossing, Rafah crossing, and he'll say, well, you know, what about the Ma'bar? Did it open yet? Is it? Because so many times he's been there with me where it's been closed and we've had to wait, you know, on the Egyptian side or in Gaza for it to open. And then, so it's become a fixture of his young life, the Rafah crossing, and he knows a lot about it. And the other day we were attending a protest in downtown Durham and here in North Carolina to end the siege, and so he was asking what it is and what it's about, and so he keeps saying, but, you know, didn't the protest help to open the border, you know? So it's, you know, he's quite aware of what's happening, as much as a four-year-old mind can be aware, at least.
Such a young age.
Yeah.
You are in the United States, of course, right now, but you've lived and worked in Gaza. What can you tell us about life in Gaza? What is it like to be a Palestinian living in Gaza today?
Well, obviously very, very difficult, but you know, in some ways I feel lucky to be able to be one of the few people who can sort of navigate both worlds, even though, you know, I don't have American citizenship or any other passport. The only documents I hold are a Palestinian Authority passport, although I feel that's a misnomer because a passport is supposed to allow you entry to your own home, but this one doesn't. So, you know, when the border is closed, of course, I can't get back. But that's all I carry is a PA travel document / passport and a Gaza residency ID card, which is issued by Israel. So that allows me, when Rafah crossing is open, entry into Gaza. So, you know, in some ways I feel lucky to be able to go there, and Gaza is my home, of course. And it's always extremely difficult. I was there between 2003 and 2006, continuously covering, reporting on the situation for various media. And, you know, being in Gaza has this effect because it becomes one of the most isolated places on Earth. You know, you've probably often heard to it referred to as the world's largest open-air prison or internment camp. My friend Daryl Lee, who's at Harvard University now and who previously was with Human Rights Watch and also lived and worked in Gaza, he just came from there and he wrote a short piece for Adala in which he calls Gaza having been transformed from a prison to a zoo, because he says in a zoo, the zookeepers are less concerned with, for the animals in the... Excuse me, that's my daughter.
No, that's all right.
For the animals in the zoo, he says, it's freedom is never an option that's even considered by the zookeepers. And so it's just a question of, you know, keeping the animals alive. And he says that's what Gaza has become. The Israelis, after the disengagement, are no longer concerned with, you know, the well-being. They'll allow in just enough. This is what the situation has come down to. They'll allow in just enough aid or humanitarian access so that an outcry can be prevented and so that the people will not, you know, starve to death, just enough to sustain them. But otherwise, they couldn't care less about, you know, their whatever, their mental well-being, their social well-being, their freedom, of course, is never an issue. So it's not on the table, this is what's interesting, is that when people discuss Gaza, it will be in terms of, or you know, critics or whatever, saying, for example, I'll frequently be asked, but the Israelis left in 2005, isn't that what you wanted? What, you know, well, the rockets continue to be fired, well, this or that. You know, as though the only issue at stake is people's economic indicators. So if people are not starving, if there's not an absolute humanitarian crisis there, then everything is okay. But that, and that's what the Israeli occupation has managed to convince people. Because of course it takes several forms. If you're familiar with Jeff Halper's work, of course, The Matrix of Control, there's many levels of the occupation. It's not just the purely physical. And in Gaza's case, what happened in 2005 in the disengagement was, and you know, that is what we refer to it as, nothing more. It's not a withdrawal. It's not. It was Israel disengaging psychologically, politically from the Gaza Strip, while not ending their occupation. So it was simply a more strategic, sinister kind of occupation, because they simply removed their troops and the illegal colonists from within Gaza, which were a huge security risk for them anyway, and took them outside, and then just controlled Gaza from the outside by land and air and sea, of course. While at the same time denying that they even control Gaza any longer, denying that they have any responsibilities for Gaza, because as an occupier, you're obliged, of course, to take care and provide for the population you're occupying. So it was this weird situation where they were still in control, still occupying. All of our paperwork had to go through them, all of our permits, our ID cards, you know, the taxation system was still under their control. I mean, you name it, it was under their control. And there's an excellent report by Gisha, which is this Israeli NGO, this Organization for the Freedom of Movement, called Disengaged Occupiers, The Legal Status of Gaza. And it's this 100-page report that describes thoroughly all these issues that are still under Israeli occupation, because it was, you know, very confusing for a lot of people. And again, it just took one more level within this matrix of control. So it, you know, it became very frustrating to be able to explain the situation to the world, and gradually Gaza became more and more isolated while somehow becoming more and more entrenched in the system of occupation.
Gaza can also be described as a concentration camp by the definition of the Webster Dictionary, which defines a concentration camp as an area whose exits and entries are totally controlled.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, exactly what it's... again, it's so difficult to really to convey the gravity of the situation as far as the borders are concerned to people, because people really cannot comprehend. When I say to them Gaza is sealed, I mean, they might nod in acknowledgement, but then they'll always say to me, so how do you get in? Or so, you know, when are you going back? Or if you want to, can you go, for example, to the West Bank or to Jerusalem? And I'll even have Israeli journalists who are very, you know, sympathetic and supposedly understand the situation say to me, well, can you come here and meet me for coffee or something? Which, of course, is impossible. I mean, when I say the borders are sealed, the borders are sealed. There is just no way for the average Gazan to go in or out of Gaza. And I should explain something, too, because Gaza has been under siege. Gaza's borders have been closed in varying degrees for more than 10 years, since the beginning of the Oslo Accords, 1993. There have been various levels of control and siege waged against Gaza. So even in the 90s, in the heyday of Oslo, when supposedly, you know, things were supposed to be good and looking up and whatever, probably for a very, you know, small percentage of the population, those affiliated with Fatah and, you know, the cronies of Fatah and so on who negotiated Oslo, you could still not get a permit. So if I was in Gaza, I wanted to go, whatever, visit family in the West Bank, or go pray in Jerusalem, or attend a conference, you know, which I had to, all three at some point. Getting a permit was not a simple process. And by permit, I mean, this is the system, the way that Israel controls the movement and the residency of Palestinians, is that if you're in the West Bank, you have to have a residency, an ID card that Israel issues. And they began doing this in 67 after they formally occupied the territories. And if you are in Gaza, you have a Gaza ID, and in Jerusalem, you have a Jerusalem ID. And if you don't have these IDs, You cannot, as a Palestinian, you're not recognized, first of all, as a Palestinian. You cannot go back and forth from the territories. So my husband, for example, he's a Palestinian refugee with a travel document for refugees from Lebanon, but he can't come visit me or come with me when we go to Gaza. And there was a process that they instituted called family reunification that should have allowed for spouses of residents to, you know, come back, but that's been frozen as well. You know, in and of itself, that's an absurd process, because if you're Palestinian, you're Palestinian, that's it. You know, you should be able to go back. But no, it only recognizes Palestinians as those that issued IDs to. Anyone else is not a Palestinian by their definition. And at the same time, though this ID allows you movement in and out, it also is, you know, not an, it also can be something that their way of controlling you. So it's somewhat of a double-edged sword. So when they close the border, such as the situation of Gaza, if you have that ID, you can't get in. You know, and when the borders are open, if you have the ID, you can get in, but only through one way or limited ways that they control. So it's very frustrating. So even in the 90s, getting permits that they issue to travel to and from Gaza, the West Bank, Jerusalem, was not an easy process. 90% of the population, you know, were unable to get those permits at one point or another. And then, of course, this was emboldened following the second intifada, and eventually got to the point where, you know, 0 to whatever 0.01% permits are issued on a limited basis. So, you know, there is no travel between the West Bank and Gaza. It's completely severed. The ties are completely severed from Gaza to the West Bank, to Jerusalem, and to the outside world, of course. And this is very significant. People don't, you know, forget about Israel, of course. I mean, they also don't issue permits for anyone to go there. And there's many, many Palestinians, of course, who have family as the Palestinian population within Israel living there. You know, we forget that there's this whole other segment of Palestinian society living there. So the siege on Gaza, always important to remember, is not something recent. It's gotten very bad, of course, recently, but has been exercised in one effect or another for over a decade.
Yeah, and it's also important to note that this system of permits, which allows Israel to keep tabs on every single Palestinian, is not only a very difficult and Byzantine system of getting a permits, but even if you have your permits, you're not necessarily allowed through anyway.
Of course.
There are many people who have been trying to get medical help, who have been denied medical help even though they have all the papers.
Yeah, absolutely. You can get, and it's happened to me, I mean, not for medical purposes, which is, of course, can be critical. I know many cases with people who are either waiting for their, you know, permits to go get medical care and have gone blind or died in the process, you know, especially cancer patients or, you know, ophthalmology patients of the eye and things like that. But there are, you know, for example, I've gotten a permit once. They've said, okay, come to the Erez crossing on so-and-so day, made me wait 14 hours, and then the permit somehow has disappeared, you know. So, again, you're right, it is a very, you know, archaic, Orwellian, you know, Kafkaesque process.
The siege which was imposed by the United States and Israel, from the moment Hamas won the parliamentary elections in January 2006, was deliberately intended to bring down the democratically elected government. Now, how did that siege affect the popularity of Hamas in Gaza?
Well, I mean, it became less of an issue of popularity as an issue of, you know, punishing the Palestinian people for a decision that not only did they make, but they were encouraged to make, and a decision that was applauded by the world. And so, you know, as you mentioned, you had a situation in the lead-up to elections where the parties were campaigning, no one said anything. And then, you know, Hamas's Change and Reform Party campaigned on the principles of change and reform, and people, for more than one reason, were fed up with Fatah, with the corruption and transparency, wanted something different. Had kind of tired of this monopoly, this political monopoly that Fatah had, and so voted for them. And you know, in surveying people, what I heard was they were not hopeful any longer of any political solution. This is in 2006 in the elections. And so the reason they voted was mainly for domestic change, because they felt they could institute that in terms of government reform, or, you know, whatever government we had, proto-government, of accountability, of just being able to see something done with the money for once, and of institutional reform and healthcare reform, things like this that they were good at, that they were efficient at. That's the main reason, because it was getting very frustrating for people. And of course the and of course the elections happened, and the sanctions were slapped on, and it was, you know, many people, I mean, the way I describe it and many people describe it is that it was this methodical effort. Oops. Gosh, I hope that wasn't on air.
No, that's okay.
So I was going to say it was this methodical effort to suffocate an entire people and to overthrow, a government that was democratically elected. And, you know, it was like no one for the longest time. You almost felt so many governments were complicit. No one, and this includes, you know, the Arab League and many Arab governments. Not as much as a peep, because I think, at least on the Arab level, people, I think many of the police states were scared that this might set a precedent, you know, having this democratic elected government. But, and, you know, same with the U.S. and Israel, is that how all of a sudden, you know, could have an Islamic movement been democratically elected by the people? It's not something that could have, that they wanted, and especially, you know, not the government that they wanted, the one that would listen to. And then they impose these conditions, because people always ask me, what are the, you know, the quartet had these three conditions of, they have to renounce violence, and they have to accept past treaties and recognize Israel's right to exist. Which, again, very much of a double standard and absurd, because, you know, the way that they have put it, and many Palestinian activists have put it, is, okay, well, when Israel recognizes Palestine's right to exist, when they recognize and abide and implement all of the various peace agreements that they have, as you said, yesed people to death with, and when they renounce violence, their violence against Palestinians, which, when you think about it, the ones that need to renounce violence are them, when you just simply look at the statistics, you know, the number of Palestinians killed, I mean, the children, number of children alone, killed by Israel, and you just look at, you know, within 1 year, hundreds versus, you know, dozens, Israelis versus Palestinians, and they are the ones that need to have a condition of renouncing violence in order to be recognized as a government. So this is just the absolute absurd and ridiculous thing about, of course, those conditions, which are, again, just a pretext and just an excuse. And nevertheless, the government, you know, did its best to appease Fatah, to appease Arab governments, went through agreement after agreement, even established a unity government with the Mecca agreement with Saudi Arabia's help. And that, too, was sabotaged. And as we know, the United States provided something by the way of $82 million or more at some point to Mohammed Dahlan, who was a Fatah strongman in charge of the security forces run by Fatah, because the security forces were not in Hamas's control. And this money, funded by the CIA and by the U.S. government, and the plan concocted by L.A. Abrams, who had also was in charge, of course, the Iran-Contra scandal, was to overthrow Hamas, to fund Fatah and the security forces, to strengthen them, to provide them with arms and funding and training, which all happened in an attempt to overthrow the Hamas government. Of course, that never happened. As you mentioned, in June, in sort of a preemptive strike, Hamas took control of the security forces.
Well, and there was ample evidence of United Nations, U.S. and Israeli-inspired.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was bound to happen. It was just, and I was there during that time, and I could tell you, it was, I mean, clear. And, you know, having spoken in length to both sides, especially to those involved, I mean, obviously the ones on the ground don't have much knowledge, but it was certainly clear, as you mentioned, there's ample evidence, it was certainly clear what was going to happen.
It was all a plot by the United States and Israel to introduce armed people into Gaza and fight Hamas.
So absolutely.
It is an open secret, though, that President Mahmoud Abbas asked Israel and Egypt to keep all crossings into and out of Gaza closed.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, that I've seen. I mean, there was a document that was leaked from Eretz that found that. And, of course, he has denied it, but it's very clear.
And yet, you know, there are some polls which claim that Mr. Abbas enjoys a greater popularity than Hamas. Why is that, do you think? I mean, is it because Mr. Abbas, who was given money to pay those who work for Fatah institutions and deny payment to those who work for Hamas institutions. And
right.
Are those polls
right? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't really been keeping track of the polls, but as I mentioned, it becomes less an issue of popularity. What this siege and what the past years have managed to do is just erase people's confidence or hope or anything in the political process. They don't believe in it anymore. The most remarkable thing about 2006, the elections, was that for the first time, Palestinian people, and I think in Arab people, suddenly had this hope and confidence and ability to not only the political process, but to do something individually by themselves, you know, the people power and the power to change something that they felt was a fixture of their lives. And in that case, it was through the elections. They were able to change the government that had this monopoly on power for so long. In the past few days, of course, it was their felling of the wall. But in that case, the elections, and so many people I've spoken to since that time, that many of them who, you know, were either independent or even who traditionally voted Fatah, in that case voted Hamas, for whatever reason, are no longer, I mean, they will tell me they just won't vote. Or they don't, even if they do, they would only vote simply to be able to have, you know, for example, borders open, even though they know that it's not going to result in a long-term solution. But they're so frustrated, they say, we don't believe in either party anymore. We'll probably just vote whatever can actually just get things going, even though we know it's not going to resolve the situation. So, I mean, what often situation like this can do is break people's will down and their hope and their confidence. And so if I explain the vote in any way, it might be in that way, not because they believe in Abbas or what he's doing or, you know, or anything like that. But, and they may very well believe in, you know, the Hamas's party's agenda and their ability to get things done if they were given a chance, which they know they haven't been and that they won't ever be. So,
is there a mechanism? Is there some kind of mechanism within Palestinian law which allows people to impeach the president or bring down the government themselves? The only way I'm familiar with is through the parliament, that the parliament can dismiss the government if with a plurality of votes. But there is nothing I could find in Palestinian law which allows for the impeachment of the president.
Right. I mean, I'm not surprised. You know, obviously, Palestinian law is takes many different legal systems into account, back from Ottoman and British and I don't know what in the 90s.
Yeah.
And yeah, right. And so it's, you know, I mean, I'm not very familiar with it, but and it's also been kind of stapled together recently, and you know, with the U.S. help, also a lot of additions added, a lot of things. So, you know, there may very well be. You're right. I know the Parliament is the way that they. But again, I mean, the problem is when people are just struggling for their daily bread at this point. When you reach a situation, I mean, the occupation really has a way of just getting to your soul and kind of destroying your will to live or to do anything. You just want, or basically just kind of existing. You know, there's a saying spray painted on the wall in the West Bank, to exist is to resist. And really, it gets to the point where just being able to go about your daily life and existing becomes a struggle and a resistance in and of itself. You know, so taking that extra step and there are segments, of course, that will do that. I mean, we've seen segments, not just in terms of trying to impeach, but in terms of doing something else, like downing the wall, that will have the energy to do that. But for the most part, so many people describe the situation as that, as one in which they just are trying to go about their daily lives. It's such a challenge, you know. So it's difficult, you know.
It is extremely difficult, and I think what holds people together is the indomitable spirit of the Palestinians, which was not crushed.
Yes.
And what the Israelis don't like the most about Palestinians is that their spirit cannot be crushed, and as a result they become more and more excessive in their violation of rights, and yet this is really the point that has to be maintained, is the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
as Stephen Biko was the activist in South Africa fighting apartheid, said, the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yes, that's true.
Given the fact that there is such a hostility between Hamas and Fatah, really, a hostility born of Israeli and American machinations, is there any way of forming a unified coalition government that will unify the nation? Because that is the only way which will give people some kind of hope through their political process.
Well, as I mentioned, there was a unity government, and it was mediated by Saudi Arabia and through the Mecca agreement, and it was sabotaged. I mean, it was, people were excited when it happened, and they were cheering the streets and throwing candy and things like this. But it's like you always felt there was this some sort of insidious element that was trying to sabotage it and ultimately succeeded. I mean, through this massive, this monstrosity, this octopus called the security forces. You know, there are like seven different wings, and no matter how many times they try to reform them or consolidate them or whatever, they continue to be under presidential control, not under the parliament. They're not transparent. They consisted of something like 70,000, individuals, and many of them were just phantom jobs that never existed, and God knows where the funding came from. It was just a disaster waiting to happen, these security forces. And no matter how they tried, there's just always something very insidious about them.
Now, there's also something one needs to say about the Qassam rockets that Israel complains about all the time, is that the vast majority of all those rocket attacks were launched by the Al-Quds Mortar Brigade, which is closely allied to Fatah.
Yes, I always make that point. I mean,
and Islamic
right.
Jihad. Islamic Jihad is a rival to Hamas.
Right,
it
right.
is
not even
Hamas.
A party, and they weren't even a party in the government, in the unity government.
Exactly.
Not only that, but on several occasions, Hamas, of course, declaring a ceasefire, a unilateral ceasefire that was not reciprocated by Israel, and offering one as recently as last week to Israel. And I think that, again, that is one of the reasons people voted for them, is because they have this political discipline. If they say they will do something, they can get their members to abide, and which is something different than Fatah, which of course splintered into many different movements and groups, that and each one kind of being led by a different party, different interests, So you're right, and there were a couple of ceasefires, and when they say we can get them to stop firing rockets, they can, they do. So,
yeah, and also there
is, of course, that's just an excuse that's used by Israel,
of course,
to wage,
yeah, and Israel also uses the time-worn way of, it's a trick that they usually use time and again, which is to invert cause and effect.
Yeah.
Because some rockets were launched as retaliation for Israel's attacks against Palestinian population centers.
Of course.
And the Israelis use the retaliation, the effect of their cause, as a cause for their attacks.
Yeah.
And
Well, it's also as though, this is what's frustrating to me, when things do come to some sort of standstill, it's like that is what, the Israelis will constantly say, yes, but the rockets are rockets. And then if they're stopped, as though that is going to resolve everything, as though, there are no rockets being fired, everything is great in Gaza. I mean, it's not. Even if we don't take Gaza, forget about Gaza, forget that there's this unprecedented, inhumane siege against Gaza. Even forget that after the disengagement, things were equally bad in terms of trade and freedom of movement and Gaza status. What about, the West Bank? What about the overall, status, Palestinian status, the refugees, East Jerusalem, the war? I mean, all these things ongoing,
yes,
in one form or another. Israel's assassinations, of mm-hmm. Palestinians also continued throughout. All of these things, of course, are ignored in the grand scheme. The media tends to kind of focus in and say, yeah, so-and-so rockets are, being fired, and somehow that justifies everything that's being done, the closures and the attacks.
As if attacking population centers with F-16s and Apache helicopters and naval gunboats isn't a form of terrorism.
Of course, absolutely.
And yet you have the a representative of the European Union who goes to Israel and says that it was right to impose the siege because of the Qassam rockets. So that public relations propaganda seems to work, as the saying
right.
goes.
Well, that's what's really scary to me, is the legal precedent this is setting, you know, because it's fine for people or governments to say, you know, and it's not fine, I mean, I'm just being sarcastic, obviously, but, you know, the for European governments, whatever, saying, yeah, yeah, sure, we agree with this, you know, Israel is our ally, this is fine, you can do this, or, you know, even if it's not overt. I mean, this is going to come and bite them, you know, one day in the behind, because this is, they're essentially sanctioning, the Israeli courts are essentially sanctioning genocide against Gaza, you know, and you know, Ilan Papa said, he hesitated to use that, but there's no other way to describe it. And that's what's happening. The courts aren't, it's not a matter of the courts saying yes or no, it's a matter of them sanctioning the degree of this torture against Gaza.
Yeah, well, but that's because lawyers are lawyers, and they're right. trained to split fine hairs. Genocide is usually associated with mass killings, and as long as they kill just only a few every day, they get by.
Exactly.
I mean, Tanya Reinhardt called this war a creeping genocide. And nobody pays attention to a creeping genocide. They want to see a massive
right.
Scale, killing on a massive scale. And yet it is a genocide by any word.
Yeah.
I don't know how one can put one's arms around this and say, what can Arab countries and Palestinians do together to make it plain that they are willing to stand up to the United States and Israel? They have to stand up for their rights, otherwise they'll be trampled.
I know.
They are
well,
next.
Well, there's not much that, obviously, I can suggest to them. I mean, on a governmental level, we all know that what they need to do and that they need to stand up, and this is an outcry. I mean, for God's sake, the day that Israel was, you know, attacking Gaza, and I don't know how many were killed that day, was it something like 20 or 30 a couple of weeks ago, you know, the Saudis were dancing with their swords with President Bush. I mean, could there have been a more pathetic, disgusting scene? I mean, it was just something that was very heart-wrenching also to watch. I mean, it was just kind of like throwing in the towel, saying, okay, there's obviously, I give up on them, there's nothing more I'm going to... But, you know, on the level of the peoples, what I still have hope in, I mean, if I could see more things being done in the Arab world by people in general, by, you know, by young people, by... I mean, I want to see mass protests, I want to see... I mean, what happened in Gaza, you know, with the wall? And, of course, this is not to discount... I mean, I always remind people that just because the wall was felled, it doesn't mean you have to understand that Gaza is still under siege and a boycott. It was a temporary opening, and it was, by the power of the people, and it's still not, it doesn't get Israel out of its responsibilities. It is still an occupier. It still has to provide for the Palestinian people and you know, stop the siege and stop the blockade. And Gaza is still part of the larger Palestinian nation, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that the people were able to do that, you know, just go there, and it was in the lead up to the felling of the wall, there was these mass protests by women and children and everything at the wall. I would have loved to see that on the other side, you know, Egyptians coming on them. And of course they tried, I know, and 500 of them were imprisoned by Hosni Mubarak in Cairo. So that's very telling. But still, I would love to see, you know, protests everywhere in the Arab world, and to demand it, and to the siege, to demand that the wall, the Rafah crossing be open, etc. You know, I mean, even in this country, all, you know, people are obviously preoccupied with the elections and whatever, but the protests that did happen were on a smaller scale. I mean, I would like to see more student activism. Something very simple, having a, they tried, I think, having a National Solidarity Day with Gaza, you know, just everyone lighting candles to represent the electricity outages and the fuel cuts.
It happened everywhere else except in Arab countries. In Egypt, for example, it is forbidden to demonstrate in public places, only in private places like the university. But the only group that has demonstrated are the Muslim Brothers.
Yeah.
And they are the only group that has defied, openly defied Mubarak.
Right.
And
that's one of the reasons, I think, I mean, getting back to politics, it's interesting that, you know, people saying, oh, Hosni Mubarak trying to take credit, saying we let them open the border. But the reality is, I mean, it was just a sign to him that Hamas could not be ignored. And if, you know, what could happen if he closed it by force would have not been pretty, obviously, and that he had to kind of deal with them as a power there. Right. But at the same time, not being able to completely, you know, there's no reason why he shouldn't just be able to open the border, Rafah crossing, and then deal with them. But of course, doing that would legitimize them as a government and as having been elected, opening the way for groups like this Muslim Brotherhood, and of course, creating a problem with the United States and Israel and Abbas, because, you know, and his little proto-government in the West Bank and all sorts of things. But anyway, I digress.
Forgive me for interrupting that. I'm giving the signal that we are beginning to run out of time. So let me ask you very quickly just a couple of questions. First, is Egypt now providing supplies to Gaza?
Well, I mean, I don't know that.
You don't know that, okay.
Specifics, but I do know that when the wall was felled, supplies did come in from many, many places, and including Egypt. Muslim Brotherhood provided a lot of supplies, I know, and in general, people who had collected donations in Egypt on a mass scale. I mean, it's so sad because the Egyptian people and the Palestinian people in Gaza have such historically such close ties. My mother always tells fondly of the time, you know, when the borders were open between 48 and 67 and how they would go to Adish or whatever and come back and just do their shopping there and come back. And that's sort of been the natural case.
Well, there was a rumor that circulated, and I wonder if you have any information on that. The rumor was that the border was actually engineered, that the burst into out of Gaza was engineered by an Israeli think tank. Is there any truth to that rumor, or would you have any information?
People are confusing. I've heard that. People are confusing two different things. Like I said, people are confusing the fact, you know, the opening of the wall, people being able to have a temporary relief from the blockade and sort of restocking and supplies, etc., and confusing that with Israel's desire to get rid of Gaza and have it under Egyptian control. I think the former wasn't the latter, you know. The wall was felled and people were able to get a breather and you know, through people power, replenishing their supplies. But certainly it's not them saying, you know, okay, now we want to be under Egyptian control. Certainly Israel wants that, and for a long time, it's not a secret, has been saying, is there some way that, and even sort of right-wing Israelis will always say to me on my blog, whatever, well, Gaza, why doesn't Gaza just go under Egyptian control? Because, you know, Egypt doesn't want to control Gaza. Gaza doesn't want to be under anyone's control, you know. Mm-hmm. But, and that's not what the border opening was about. I mean, Israel probably hoped and said, okay, maybe we can make our dream come true. Finally, you know, a responsibility of Gaza. We can get rid of it. This disaster, we don't want Gaza, have someone else take care of it. But, you know, that's not what this was.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Yeah. We'll have to leave it at that. Naila, thank you so much for being our guest today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You have been listening to Ms. Laila Al-Haddad, who is a well-known Palestinian journalist and has a blog at amotherfromgaza.blogspot.com. amotherfromgaza.blogspot.com. And this is all we have for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. This is Sharif Pham, signing off for now.